When we first started to map out plans for this podcast on public relations and the media, one of the very first names we wrote down on our guest wish list was Dawson Bell. Dawson is now retired, but it's too cold to be golfing today, so he is with us to talk about his 27 years as a reporter with the Detroit Free Press, and also his thoughts on journalism today and how he spent last election day. You're listening to the Cold Oatmeal Podcast.
Welcome to Cold Oatmeal, a podcast by the Rush Strategies team about PR and public affairs. Really.
I was distracted staring at Joe's cold oatmeal.
Yeah, well, it's here.
He's got it on his
desk. It's always right here. Now. It's always here.
And by the way, the ratio of like fruit to disgusting, like 1 to 10, it's got some disgusting stuff in some fruit. Yeah,
there's nothing disgusting.
One part fruit.
What in there is disgusting?
I don't even know what's in it, but it looks like cucumber mash and maybe a couple of chopped apples.
Did you have Burger King for breakfast? What was your...
Say that!
Okay, welcome back to the Cold Oatmeal Podcast. My name is Matt Resch, president of Resch Strategies, and your host for the podcast. We are trucking full speed into episode number 3. We appreciate all those who have listened to our pilot episode and the first couple of episodes that we've put out there. I think I knew we had arrived when I received an email from a publicist from a marketing firm in London asking if their CEO could be a guest on the podcast.
I thought they were from Norway.
Well, they were all over the place. Okay. They had offices in London, Norway. There were some U.S. offices too. So I think when I got that email when the robots sent that to me about 6 hours after the first podcast went live, I knew that we had arrived and we were reaching some real audiences there. But good work, everyone. Things are going well. Feedback has been good.
Anyway. When are they coming in studio?
Well, we're trying to make travel arrangements for
Christmas
that.
Episode.
Christmas,
awesome.
Okay. So. Sure, they're not Russian trolls.
I hope.
Can't be sure of that ever anymore.
Trolls are great at Christmas. No, that would be. So feedback has been good. We've gotten some very friendly emails, and some folks are listening. So we will continue at this, and hope we can continue to be entertaining and informative. So. If you're listening, you've obviously found us. We are at the Cold Oatmeal Podcast at reststrategies.com. We are also on iTunes at the Cold Oatmeal Podcast. And if either of those don't work, you can type in thecoldoatmealpodcast.com and you can download our episodes there. I did mention last time, and I'm going to mention every time we talk, special thanks to our musical partners, Brian Western and Pete Mowry of Western and Mowry. Their music is part of our intro, and also we play them throughout the show. You can find them on iTunes and also at westernandmowry.com. And to Nick Piazza, nickpiazza.com, also on iTunes, has helped us out with the music. So that has been a real a good part of this thing. Gotten a lot of feedback from folks who like Brian, like Pete, and they like the stuff that Nick has given to us. So thank you for that. So why don't we get started? Dawson, welcome to the Cold Oatmeal Podcast.
Couldn't be happier to be here.
I can tell. We are joined here. Dawson joins us in the studios, and let's introduce the rest of us. Stephanie
Van Coovering with the Rush team.
Joe Besci.
Yeah, Nick DeLuce here.
I do want to give a shout out to Joe, a little Rick Snyder shout out before we get started here, because the last 35 minutes have been hot and hairy of stress and cussing because the equipment didn't work. But we are going. We are going.
Well,
we think we're going.
Maybe.
We think we're going. But thank you, Joe, for powering through and getting us to this point. So, Dawson, you were at the Free Press for 27 years. Is that right?
That sounds right, yeah.
I read it on LinkedIn, so someone must have set up an account for you.
No, I think I probably set it up. Never used it, but
that's the story of everybody on LinkedIn.
Now, obviously, we know you and got to know you best when you covered state government and politics. But were there other things you covered throughout your career in those early 20s, earlier in those 27 years? What beats did you have?
Yeah, at the Free Press, I did politics almost from the get. But prior to working at the Free Press, I was with the Oakland Press in Pontiac for several years, and the Flint Journal, believe it or not, used to have a real newspaper. And I covered a lot of cops and city hall stuff.
Okay.
And, you know, just did sort of, I mean, it was a very, very different era where, you know, the local newspaper had an intimate relationship with the community and the police department. We were, you know, the Flint cops, and, you know, in the early 1980s was, you know, the Wild West. It was really fascinating stuff for a young reporter. But eventually I just sort of copped out and started covering politicians. Don't ask me why. I think it was, you know, some kind of curse.
Was there a beat that you liked better? If you look back, was
no. I've always been a sports nut, and I always read the sports pages before I read anything else in the paper. Still do. In fact, it's about the only thing I read anymore. And I thought a little bit about becoming a sports writer, but believe it or not, in those days the sports department was viewed as sort of they used to call it the toy department every once in a while, and you know, I sort of, you know, when you're young, people that act like they think they're important make an impression, and the politicians and government people all acted like they were doing significant things, and a lot of people seemed to believe they were, and so it seemed like a serious business, and I thought of myself then as a serious person. I've gotten over it.
So you fell for it, and sports fell away, and you've regretted it ever since?
Yeah. Okay. I actually never did any sports reporting, but I always sort of thought, at one time I applied to be the Tigers beat writer for the Free Press, but that was within a year or two after I arrived there, and I know they didn't seriously consider it.
I've heard from folks who've made their hobby their profession.
Yeah.
And whether or not they I had a friend who, you know, loved the Cleveland Indians more than life and himself, and he got his dream job out of college working as an intern and then as a PR person for the Cleveland Indians. And it was interesting to talk to him, you know, years after that. Like, he loved nothing more than going to Indians games, but when it became his job, and his job was running from the, you know, the dugout to the press room with stats and things, it became less his hobby and more a profession, and not as much anything that he liked.
I've thought about that before, and I feel like I would be completely heartbroken if I pursued something like, oh, I'm going to love this. This is going to be amazing. I'm going to have so much fun. I'm part of Notre Dame's football team in some way, and then it's like, oh, I got to get up every day, and now I do this, and it's my job, and now I don't have anything that I love on the side, and life is horrible. I feel like that's how that would go for me.
Usually the life is horrible theme is a common thread in stories that Joe tells.
It's true.
So was the political beat a choice on your part, or was it an assignment that got and you decided?
Actually, I was first working in Oakland County for the Free Press, and it was 1985, 86, and... Dan Murphy, who was then the Oakland County executive, was, for some reason or other, thought of as a possibly strong gubernatorial candidate for the Republicans. This would have been Jim Blanchard's first reelection when he ultimately ran against Bill Lucas. And so I got assigned to the Dan Murphy campaign, which was a train wreck from start to finish. But you know, kind of liked it, and the thing that drew me in after, you know, as the years went on, was all the people that I met. You know, I really liked a lot of the people. I liked a lot of elected officials. I liked judges. I liked the staffers, and found that I was, you know, sort of well suited to it.
Well, I know in my experience with you, you've always tried to make a point of kind of embedding yourself with someone for a day or two to really kind of get a sense of who they were and what they were like behind the scenes when they weren't giving a speech or giving an interview. Have any, aside from the obvious one, which is the story that you and I share, which is the day that you embedded with Dick Postumus on 9/11.
Yeah.
We don't need to dwell on that one, but is there another memorable day that you can think of as, you know, a day you spent with a politician that was something that sticks out?
And I'm keenly interested in this answer, having embedded with you several times on different campaigns.
Part of that part of that is laziness, because if you're embedded a politician, you don't have to be writing a daily story. You know, you can say, oh, well, I'm getting all this deep background. You can't bother me today. I really started doing that kind of work seriously in the Engler campaigns, 1989-1990. Got to know some of the people that were on that campaign and spent a lot of time, probably more time with him than I did with anybody else subsequently. I was on the road with them, you know, close to a dozen times. And it's true that you do get some insight into it, because nobody can maintain that phony veneer of the public persona around the clock, and they recognize it, and you recognize it, and you come to agreements about what stuff is for the record and what's not. I had come to Lansing thinking that John Engler was sort of this Machiavellian, frightening, powerful guy in the who had this reputation of manipulating other people and getting his way, and he was all of those things, but he also had a terrific sense of humor and considerable self insight, I thought, and was fun to be around. I remember we went through Yale one time and stopped in at this realtor's office, and there was a flyer on the desk advertising the Yale Bologna Festival.
I've heard of that.
Well,
yeah,
I've
never been.
You guys, having been in politics, you probably got invited to the parade several times. But Engler, just like that, as soon as he saw that flyer, said, yeah, I hear the governor's the grand marshal this year and every year at the Bologna Festival. And he said it in a much funnier way than I did. But it was the kind of thing that he wouldn't say in a speech or even in a casual chat. And it sort of gave me some insight into how his mind worked. And I remember it now, 30 years later. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you have looking back on your reporting days, is there any project or series of stories that you look back and are the most proud of that you've done?
Well, I did some of the work on the Kwame Kilpatrick stuff, which won a Pulitzer Prize, so you're supposed to get
be very proud of that.
Self-congratulatory about that sort of thing. I've got that, a nice...
Does that prize, like, spend a weekend with you once each year? I mean, how do you guys divvy up a prize like that?
I got a nice certificate that was on very high quality paper.
All right. And it's framed and probably displayed.
To be fair, ML Elric and Jim Schaefer were the lead reporters on that, and the only reason that we won the Pulitzer, really. I mean, I wrote a story about Kwame stealing money from the state government before he started stealing it from Detroit that was included in the submission. And those guys got to go to banquets and wear tuxedos and stuff, not me. But, there are a lot of stories that were fun to write. I remember writing a story about the huge lawsuit against the state over blocking oil drilling in the Nordhaus Dunes up in Ludington. It was a really fun story because it had been in the news and the state had lost $120 million judgment or something, and then finally ended up settling it. I don't remember for how much, because they denied these guys their rights under they'd purchased, the oil and gas rights for this property, and then the state wouldn't let them use them, and it had been reported one way for, you know, practically a generation. And then I went back and looked at all the paperwork and talked to some of the people who were involved and found out that really, it was, you know, the state was just one blunder by the state after another, and I thought I did some nice writing on that too. You know, in those days it mattered how you wrote in a newspaper, and it doesn't seem to so much anymore. But
well, that leads me to the next question. If anyone else wants to jump in here too, I'm curious. You know, as you've now been observing your profession for 5 years after participating in it for longer than that. Is there anything that you find most interesting or surprising? What surprises you the most about how journalism has changed since you did it on a daily basis?
At my age, you don't get surprised by much, but I'm sort of saddened by the quality of the product. The Free Press recently shipped all their copy editors out. They're doing the copy editing in Indianapolis or Tennessee or someplace. And it's so often anymore, it would appear that nobody's reading the copy other than the one who wrote it.
Mm-hmm.
Obvious mistakes get left in all the time now. Plus, it's so fragmented, too. There are still a few reporters. My former colleague, Paul Egan, at the Free Press, who is still there, does just a tremendous job of covering various aspects of state government, has terrific sources, and uncovers blunders and malfeasance and all that kind of stuff on a regular basis. But there's just so... There's so much less of that going on. You pick up a Free Press from 1988, and there would be a dozen stories in there with things that nobody else was reporting and that nobody else knew, and that the paper had done a terrific job of sourcing and writing and editing that's just not there anymore. Everybody sees it. Those. Mm-hmm. One of our sports columnists this weekend had some innocuous quote in one of these stories that said, and then parenthetically at the end of the paragraph it said, "Be sure to CQ," which is news speak for make sure that this is right. And the author of the piece had obviously put that in there,
mm-hmm.
and that meant that the editor or the copy editor or page designer, whoever was handling the copy subsequent to him, somebody was supposed to check that stuff, make sure it was right, and then take that parenthetical reference out. Just went straight through and presumably never got checked either. It might have been wrong.
Maybe the person didn't even know what it meant. They got it. Well, and it's not that our appetite for news is less, because it seems like, at least, we're being hit more and more with yeah. more and more stuff. Is it our energy level and our work ethic and in putting the time in to read something of that length and depth that has caused it?
You better ask your next guest about that. I have no idea. The reason the newspapers don't do it the way they once did is purely financial. They just mm-hmm. don't have the resources anymore. But I, what that says about the consumers' aptitudes and interests, I don't know. Let's face it, journalists always take news a lot more seriously than news consumers do. We always thought we were doing something important when everybody realized that it didn't matter that much.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because I've been interested to see when you mentioned the shipping of the editing down to, I think, is it Tennessee, I think, that they're doing it to, the Free Press is sending it to. I've seen on Facebook this last week a couple of newspaper people, posting pictures of the front page and just saying how awful they think it looks. Yeah. And I look at it and I think, I don't really notice what they're talking about, but those people who've spent their life in the business are picking out things that immediately jump off the page at them as this is not the way that we used to do things, or not the way it should be doing.
Yeah.
And so it's been interesting to watch, and then to see them kind of get into discussions about those who are still being paid to defend the way it's happening right now and those who are free to say, no, this looks like crap.
Well, I'm one of those who thinks it does look like crap, but I also... I asked my wife if she had noticed when they did it, and she said, "No, what's different?"
Right.
And to me, it's night and day. But as I think I saw one of those discussions too, and as one of the former editors that chimed in said, we got this kind of grousing every time we changed the design over the years. That's something that they would do every 5 years or so anyway, and change typeface and layout and stuff like that. That's what I hope this is not going to become, is things were so much better in the old days kind of conversation.
Well, we won't do that. You mentioned John Engler. Is there, would you put him as maybe the most interesting person you covered, politician you covered, or is there some another personality that you would say this is the most interesting person I had a chance to spend time with?
I covered him more thoroughly than almost anybody else in my career, but there were some characters and oddballs. I mean, just to name a couple of them, I covered Dave J extensively. Oh, yeah. And he was a full-blown banana, you know. I mean, and got himself into these incredible scrapes, but he was just a fascinating character, and had the capability of making people so angry. I mean, he was really before his time in that sense. And then, of course, Jeff Figer was, he was a gift when it came to covering that 98 campaign.
He makes people angry, too.
Well, and you know what's funny? My son, there was a Figer commercial. My wife was telling me that they were at the doctor's office, and there was a Figer commercial on TV. And my son walked by the TV and said, "Look, it's President Trump." And I'm like, I was like, my wife's like, "Well, not really, but yeah, kind of." Actually, Stephanie was just talking last week about doing a blog about trying to go find David J. and writing a story about what her adventure was going to be like, trying to track down David J. and figure out what he's doing.
I would love to see what he's up to, what he thinks. You know, be fascinating.
Yeah.
Be careful.
You don't want to look in there. You don't want to look in there. Where...
Hey, I in the latter stages of my career a couple of times, because I had a pretty good relationship with him at one time, and I thought maybe he would agree to do a kind of look back in sorrow sort of story. And I did contact him, and there was zero interest. He just went on to a completely...
What happened to him? Where is he now?
You can
answer Stephanie's question for us.
He was back in Macomb.
Okay.
He'd spent a lot of time, like, in Korea, teaching English as a second language, and then in Florida for a while, some kind of online school. He almost earned a PhD at Michigan State. He was, I think, at the very end stages of it when his career blew up.
Everybody's entitled to a fresh start.
Yeah.
Yes.
So, looking at your experiences kind of from a PR standpoint, you know, Nick was describing the other day how, on some of your embedded trips, folks would try to set newspapers up, catch your eye with various things, really stage environments for you. Did you experience any kind of over-the-top behavior from the PR flacks that you worked with, without naming names, of course?
You can name names, too. As long as they're not in this room.
You guys have insurance.
I'm not sure our insurance covers guests on a new podcast that four people are listening to, but we'll try.
You can go on your auto policy. It'll be fine.
It's just sort of a... personal, personal style question that I reacted badly whenever someone that was fronting for a candidate or representing a candidate or a campaign or whatever tried to tell me something that I knew that they knew was not true. And that happens a lot in a campaign, but you know, you're dealing with people that are generally pretty savvy, pretty smart, and know what's real and what's not. And I had no patience for that, especially when whoever it was that I was dealing with would get argumentative about it and get self-righteous when I knew that it wasn't sincere. Mm-hmm. Fortunately, I worked with you guys a few times with candidates who were flawed, some of them seriously flawed.
No.
But as far as I can recall, neither one of you guys ever tried to run anything over on me with let's not name names, but, you know, there were, play it straight. That's the thing that I always... respected the most and thought was most useful both for me and for the subject of whatever we were covering.
Well, when you and I got together for lunch a few weeks ago, you told me a story that I don't think you apparently don't find it very interesting. I found it very interesting. And we don't talk about politics really and partisan stuff on this podcast, but tell us where you spent Election Day of 2016 and why.
Well, you know, it wasn't that long ago, so we can all recall that the 2016 campaign was a parallel universe. It was unlike anything any of us had ever experienced before. Two awful candidates and the coverage was relentlessly negative. I certainly by midsummer was just despairing. I knew one of them had to be president, but I didn't see anything positive about the outcome, no matter what. So I have some old friends that I talk to and talk politics to on a regular basis. One of them lives in Montana, and we had in our younger years we'd spent a lot of time in the mountains. We did some long mountaineering trips, and both sort of loved the outdoors. And at some point, one of us suggested—I don't even remember who it was—that we plan a trip right around the election, it wasn't conscious immediately. I mean, it wasn't deliberate immediately that we would cut off communication with the outside world. It'd just be sort of a distraction, so we didn't have those last frantic days. Would not be, one spent opening up the damn phone every 5 seconds to see what was happening. Because we didn't want to know that badly, and we ended up going off into the Bridger Mountains in Montana and spending 3 days, a couple of nights. I think we left Monday maybe and came back on Thursday, and we were in a place where we didn't have cell service and didn't have, and there was no communication with the outside world. Just gorgeous, gorgeous country, and at least in Montana. I can't remember what it was like here, but in Montana, through the election last year, was gorgeous weather, 70 degrees, and then in early November, we just tuned out. And I remember they had we stayed one night in this National Forest Service cabin, these rustic cabins that don't have power, but they've got a little wood stove, and there was a log book in there, and people had for several years had been recounting their experiences at this cabin. Some of them were really fun. There were a lot of people that had, gotten out of jail after 90 days and went out in the woods to get drunk. And but I can remember on Wednesday night, that full 24 hours after whatever had happened, that we wrote in the journal something like, "Well, it's 24 hours later, and we don't know, but we know it's bad."
So, how did you find out?
We came out eventually, and I called home, and
okay,
and I think I talked to my wife, and she said, "You're not going to believe what's happened." She was right.
And you immediately turned around and went back into the mountains.
Well, I'm not ashamed to say I voted for him. I mean, I think he's a nut and an awful, but I voted for him. I mean, I think she would have been worse.
I agree with you. I did the same thing, much to the chagrin of several of my never-drunk colleagues.
Well, I just find it fascinating, the idea that, my wife and I always talk about the need to cut off or disconnect or to turn the stupid phone off. And she was even reading to me an article about how it's bad to have your cell phone plugged in on your nightstand next to your bed because waves are coming out of it that affect your sleep patterns. And she's now plugging it in the kitchen because she doesn't want I have a hard time not looking at it in over a 2 minute period. But I think if there were 3 days to be disconnected from the world, those were probably three good days to pick.
Yeah, it was wonderful. So. It didn't change anything. I don't think it was decisive in the outcome. But.
You had voted absentee. Well, Dawson, we appreciate you coming by. This has been a lot of fun. And I know that this is your first podcast experience. Hopefully you'll come back again at some point if we're still around doing this for a second rerun, for rerun guests. But we appreciate you coming by and spending some time with us.
You bet. Nice talking to you.
Thank you.
Lovely lady, lying in my bed, didn't hear what I said, it's just a dream, sex is Sadie, it's ringing in my head.
So what are everybody's plans? Is everybody home?
No. My family goes to...
Stop.
Oh, sorry.
That's the whole point.
Okay.
Well,
we're
recording, aren't we?
We are, but I'm trying to get my clock to work. Hang on.
Or so it seems. Now it's gone, 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 gone. Gone, 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 gone. Gone, 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 gone.
Welcome back to the Cold Oatmeal Podcast. We are thankful that Dawson was able to be with us, and we're thankful that it's Thanksgiving week. I think one thing that we all seem to share is a love of the Pilgrims and the tradition that they started here in our country.
Absolutely.
Love the Pilgrims. Cooper, my son, was supposed to dress up like a Pilgrim this morning, and we were woefully unprepared to help him do this, and so he wanted to wear his gym t-shirt, his Pilgrim Play t-shirt, because I'm sorry, I should have said that the school mascot are the Pilgrims, and so he said the only way I can do is dress up like a Pilgrim is to wear my gym shirt because it says Pilgrim Play, so that was what he was going to be wearing for their Thanksgiving lunch.
I don't even know what a Pilgrim looks like. What?
They have a hat,
kind of like a Quaker
with the big white collar.
You're an oatmeal eater.
Okay. It's yeah. Like the Quaker Oats guy. That's like the poor kid oatmeal. I'm buying organic steel cut stuff.
Sorry, silly.
Whole Foods oatmeal only. Yeah. Anyway, so Thanksgiving. It's Thanksgiving week. One of our favorite holidays. What's your plans? What's everyone's plans? Stephanie, we'll start with you.
Okay. We will go to my Aunt Margie's in Ann Arbor. I call it Aunt Margie's, even though her daughter Jill has inherited the holiday, but it's still Aunt Margie's.
Is Aunt Margie still with us?
Yes, she just turned 91 years old.
Wow, God bless
her. And so we
the
will
big
go...
The big 9-1.
The big 9-1. She is awesome. And so we will go to eat a great big meal. It will be very Norman Rockwell. huge crowd comes, about 25 of us, which is small this year, but big.
At their house?
At their house. And then we will divide up, and the men will all go sit in one area of the house and watch football, and the women will all sit in the kitchen and trash everyone who isn't there. So it's a really great holiday.
Fun.
Yeah.
It's like the true meaning of Thanksgiving, right there. That is the true meaning.
You'll bash anyone who isn't in the kitchen or anyone who isn't at the home?
We actually just trade stories about what everybody's up to.
Don't back away from that. Yeah. That's good.
All right. There is a little gossip that usually happens about some of the folks. Little bit of judgment that happens. But what's Thanksgiving without
That's what the holiday's all about.
A little judgy. Sure.
There's no way that the Duluth family does anything like... You guys don't bash anyone. I cannot imagine you guys doing any of that.
No, we don't. We're pretty wholesome.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah.
You probably, and since there are 150 of you, I'm sure you all say what you're thankful for. It probably takes 4 hours.
We actually do, and it's lovely, Mother, if you're listening. It can be super annoying because we tend to start with the youngest and then move to the oldest, and that was easy enough when there were just the 10 of us plus my folks, but now that we've added in-laws. And we've added grandchildren, whenever they're all together in the same place and you try and get these ages going, it's not as easy as going Max, Carly, Ben, Ted, going up from the bottom. You've got to go, okay, now is Daniel Armstrong older than Jonathan Terpstra? Like, where do the in-laws fit and where do the grandkids fit? And we just get out of order. But everyone's like insistent, we've got to get the order right. I don't know. We make it work.
At some point, you don't even know everyone. You're like, who's Jonathan Armstrong?
I would wonder if Jonathan Armstrong was there. Who are you? It's a problem I don't have to deal with this year. So Sarah works, you know, nights at Sparrow. And every other year she has to do Thanksgiving. She's gotten out of it a couple of times. But so this is her year. And so for the second time in our marriage, she's said, oh, it's okay. Just go to Grand Rapids. Go be with your family. The implication being that she'll wake up at 4 o'clock and then have like a lean cuisine for Thanksgiving dinner. And so I have to tell her, no, darling, we'll stay home and I'll cook. I'll do the turkey. And let's have your folks over and let's have your sister over and let's have the kids over. And I'm just a little nervous about it. The first time we did that was a couple of years ago, and had it in mind to clean the oven the night before. I was telling Matt this earlier. We'll clean the oven, and so you set the auto clean thing, you know, mm-hmm. and it locks down, like you hear this latch, you know, engage, and it cleaned, but it got so hot it fried the circuits in the computer, and so it wouldn't unlock. But of course we cleaned it the night before, so Thanksgiving morning I wake up and I go to put the turkey in, and like the thing won't open. You cannot get it open, and so I had to call my.
So you had lean cuisine.
Yeah, we would have if the in-laws hadn't been 5 miles down the road. And so they came and picked up the turkey and brought it to their house and cooked it there and then brought it back. So you can imagine the look on my face this week when Sarah said, you know what we should do before we cook? We should probably clean the oven again. I said, No.
Yeah, I'm let's done get some easy off.
And right, yeah. Yeah, no thanks.
My mom started a strange thing not a few years back where we would arrive back for Thanksgiving. And she would have gone someplace. I'm not sure what kind of store you have to go to find these things, but they were candles in the shapes of pilgrims and Indians and turkeys.
I remember those.
And they would always be there. Would always be like the serious centerpiece for the table, but then there would be the fun centerpiece. And she would light. She would like gleefully light the pilgrims on fire, and then like the really cheap candles, like they burned down to nothing in a matter of minutes. And so the sport was whether or not, you know, are the pilgrims going to make it through dinner before they're melted in a pool of wax and cheap plastic in a cup on the table. So we'll see. We'll see what kind of, you know, Thanksgiving mascot she's found in wax form when we arrive in Minnesota this year.
That's awesome.
What are you doing, Joe?
It's always the same thing for us. My mom always does Thanksgiving forever and always, and my parents are in Diamondale, so it's basically I'll be here in town, and I think this year it'll just be my immediate family. Usually there's a couple uncles, but I think they both have plans with their other side of the family. But yeah, it's pretty low stress, low stakes holiday for the Beshe household.
Are there traditions attached?
Not really. We're not, I mean, we might have the Lions on, like, only because people like Steve will want to sort of watch the Lions, but I don't care. We usually watch, actually we do, we have two traditions. We sort of watch two movies fairly regularly. Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, Thanksgiving classic. And then the one that is moderately embarrassing but I love is the 1993 hit, Son-in-Law, starring Pauly Shore, which is also a Thanksgiving movie.
Oh my goodness.
That definitely gets watched. So we'll have those queued up. I don't know.
That's awesome.
I have Christmas stories. I don't have any that great Thanksgiving stories. I have funny Christmas tales we can share on a later podcast. But
well, I think generally Thanksgiving is just kind of a low-key. That's why I like it so much. It's not really much stress. Granted, I've only had to cook the dinner once. And I didn't really do much of that part, but I can imagine it being stressful for those responsible for feeding the guests. But it's just kind of a low key, easy going place, time to hang out.
I found the last few years my favorite part of Thanksgiving. Sarah always orders pies from Grand Traverse Pie Company. We get the appleberry cherry, you know, do the cherry pie. I found the last couple of years my favorite part of the entire holiday is going in to pick those up the night before Thanksgiving, and it's the people watching. As people come in the night before Thanksgiving to Grand Traverse Pie Company and ask for a pumpkin pie and are shocked and astounded to learn that they really needed to pre-order their pumpkin pie. There are no more pumpkin pies in the entire state of Michigan, and they're out of luck. And people get pretty sour pretty fast, but it can be fun if you're not stuck in that predicament.
It was the worst Thanksgiving ever.
Yeah.
No pies. Well, I wish you all a good Thanksgiving, and to our listeners and the Cold Oatmeal Podcast, thanks. Happy Thanksgiving to all of you as well. To Dawson Bell, thank you for being here. We enjoyed our talk. To Nick Piazza, Brian Westren, Pete Mowry, our musical friends, thank you to you too. Have a great holiday, and we'll talk to you soon on the Cold Oatmeal Podcast. Last week's sunlight, I need to warm my bones. Sometimes I feel alone. That's just me. I'm still struggling to find a little flame. You barely know my name. Well, let's just see.